Hello and welcome to the We All Succeed podcast, a podcast dedicated to business strategy and to being able to cause a huge impact by people who are actually already succeeding in business and causing that huge impact. Today I have an incredible business mind and financial mind, William Rassman. He owns his own financial company where he's helping maintain and manage people's assets, usually people who have over $1 million of investable assets. Today, we're going to try and skirt around any kind of issues that we might have about legality and make sure that we're 100% compliant. So you might hear an occasional cut or whatnot, just to make sure that everything is on par with what is important for legality purposes. Also, we'll be talking about Will's amazing book, just coming out, hot, fresh off the press. William Rassman, thank you for joining. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks so much for having me, Ryan.
Thanks for the invitation. It's always exciting to speak with a financial professional. Financial professionals in one way or the other, whether it's somebody who's helping get loans, that's one of the big cruxes of what's going on in today's business world and also in a lot of people's personal lives. And whether it's some of our previous people who have joined, which is the helping of acquisition of loans and those kind of things, or important topics like what you've written your book about, Atlas Shift, we've got some amazing topics that I'm hoping to cover with you today, if you'll let us.
We'll see how many we can get. But yeah, I'm ready whenever you are.
Awesome. So we've got a book. I want to talk about that first, because you've chosen a really interesting topic, Atlas Shift, Mastering Your Financial Experience in a Post-Information Age. Is that right?
That's right.
Why was that the topic? What caused that to be the topic for you to write a book about?
So it seemed to me that, you know, as I've, approached a better part of a decade in this industry, that I seem to witness a few things changing in, and as I write about in the intro to my book, it's kind of like, you know, I grew up playing hockey, and one of the things that you worry about when you're playing hockey or any sport for that matter is kind of, where the game is going to go next, right? So, or where the puck is going. So, knowing that I keep my eye on the future, I've found that staying ahead of the curve is much better than being behind it. And so what has lent me to this way of thinking is really looking at the fact that it seems as if the government and corporations and, you know, bureaucratic sources of taking care of your later years of financial life seem to be dissipating. So what I mean by that is we don't know when Social Security is going to run out, right? Who knows? 2034, 2030. There's different projections on that, but the pension is all but gone, you know, except if you're a government employee, but who knows? I mean, in California, we have, as you might know, we have CalPERS, which is the teacher's pension that they always talk about, you know, is it running out of money and how long are they going to be able to pay people for it? And so what I see happening is that the responsibility for your current and future financial household is really on you. And that's where the title Atlas Shift comes from. Atlas, the Greek Titan of, who was actually assigned to hold up the sky. Some people think that he puts the world on his shoulders, but he's putting a celestial sphere on his shoulders. A metaphor of holding up the sky to make sure it doesn't crash down on Earth, which
I'd really like to jump in here for a moment, because you said Sure. Some very powerful stuff, and I don't want any of the listeners to skip on past it, because there's some really important things in there, right? Yeah. You know, you chose a book that was handling the financial future of a post-information age, the age that we're currently living in now. And you talk about that a little bit in the book. But what you just said right there is a lot of what would we considered reliable, the things that, you know, our parents would have been considered reliable, the way that pensions worked and all of that money is running out. So the people who were expecting to get that kind of American dream of the 9-to-5 job where the company takes care of you afterwards, you get your Social Security disability, you know, that kind of industrial age mentality that the baby boomers had, that's running out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's powerful. That's very important, especially, you know, here on We All Succeed, we try to get into the nitty and gritty of that. And this is the first time a lot of that information is popping up for a lot of the listeners. So I'd like you to jump into that and dive in a little bit more, because you deal with this on a daily basis. You're a partner at your company that handles these financial matters and handles the wealth management for people who have more than $1 million of investable assets. And so I'd like to dive into what that changes for people who are maybe expecting to be able to rely on these services, especially teachers, and are not going to be able to rely on these services. And as well, you know, for the little guy, for people who've got, you know, maybe less than $80,000 of investable assets. Right. I'd like to hear the difference between those two as well.
Sure. So I think where the rubber really meets the road, going back to the whole Social Security and pension issue, is that a lot of those, or the majority of those types of financial vehicles were meant for folks in the industrial age, right? They were meant for people that that worked physically a little bit more than the more service-based type of industry that we have today, right? So if you're working at a factory in front of machines all day, it's more than likely that at some point you won't be able to do that anymore. And so that's really what Social Security and corporate pensions were designed for, is to help out the person at the end of their working life. I think that it's probably hard to argue nowadays for the majority of us that work in service-based type stuff, or you know, that complain about being in front of the computer all day, that we wouldn't be able to do that past 65 or 70. I think that you know, I talk about in my book that that longevity is probably is a bigger issue than dying too young. I think that outliving your money, to the majority of people that we're talking to right now, is a bigger risk than dying too soon. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's another shift. And these are all, you know, these are outlined in my book. These different shifts all line up to around the fact that more than ever, you are now responsible for taking care of all of this stuff that is going to come up. And and I'd argue that the first step in doing all that is to accept the responsibility of it. I mean, it's really difficult to try and fix things that you don't believe you're responsible for. And
so I've got to ask the big questions, right? So when we talk about the different people who are so directly affected by this, you know, as an investor myself, I speak to, you know, my fellow investors just to know who the smart people in the room are. And often I expect to see, you know, occasionally it's somebody who acquired their money because somebody passed away in the family. That's kind of a common one. Sure. Lawyers, firefighters with their pension, police officers, teachers who have, you know, graduated from teaching and are now in retirement. And most of these people are either hoping to create a new business or hoping to extend their money out past, you know, the amount of time they're going to be alive and really just retire. Mm-hmm. Who all is affected by this? Are all of those affected by this? You mentioned teachers. So, you know, that makes me worried as well about police officers, firefighters, those kind of people.
Yeah, I think that any time that you are in a sense, you know, crowdfunding, to use today's term, future retirement for large bodies of people, that there's going to be some sort of friction that comes up with that. And I think that to answer your question, I think that's across industries. I think that government employees of all stripes are going to eventually feel the pinch of of what is kind of coming down the road, which is that people are living too long and the benefits are too high. So the way in which you fix that, right, is you cut the benefits, right? Because you're not going to make people die before they want to.
Right.
So by cutting benefits, it's, I think that will probably be the way in which we, quote unquote, fix Social Security, is make people work longer and cut the amount of money that actually goes out to people. And who knows if that'll shift into some sort of Medicare situation or whatever it is. But the point of it is that the money that you earn based upon the value that you're giving to society needs to be the money that you count on for long-term resources. It can't be counting on another institution or another way, another vehicle to do so.
Do you feel like this is pushing the rise of the entrepreneur? I see always on Forbes articles all the time, they're talking about how there's more entrepreneurs than ever before, more people, and people who usually have what are considered quote unquote stable jobs, including teachers, are now driving Uber and all these things as an extra way to either make ends meet or save up. Do you think this is one of those things that is kind of pushing that envelope and pushing people more to be entrepreneurs? Or do you think that there's probably something else pushing that?
Well, to me, that's a very interesting concept to kind of think about, because it's kind of chicken or the egg-ish. Mm. Because technology has brought us to a place where you know, you're able to work longer hours, right? Because it's not as physically strenuous, and you're able to reach more people. So I think that technology, I mean, I don't think that anybody would disagree with me that it has bred so much more innovation that we really don't even know what to do with it all. And I think that we won't even really know, you know, the long-term health effects of all of this until, you know, it's probably too late, 30, 40, 50 years down the road. So that said, we've gone from pretty drastically, you know, from pretty much, you know, the 90s up until today, where dot-com businesses are ruling the commerce part of our lives. So it's kind of like, I think that people that went into traditional type jobs have finally seen over time that they can also be an entrepreneur. Like, they have that built inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you asked people in the 1800s to be entrepreneurs, it was like, there's no way you could do it, right? I mean, you had to have tons and tons of funding. And now it's like, and you had to have, you know, you really had to have your ducks in a row. Today you can, you know, there's businesses that you can do via your phone, right? Like Uber and stuff. So I think that, you know, what might be igniting the rise of the entrepreneur is just the ability to do so. But I think that it also is that there's so much more of the pie out there for everybody that it seems as if it's easier to reach. So why not? You know what I mean? It's more of like a risk and reward type of thing. It's like, you don't have to leave everything behind to start your side gig, and you can just start it and then just kind of see what happens. And that is, I think it has lowered the barrier to entry for entrepreneurship, which I think is a good thing. Because we need more people creating more value so that they're bringing in more monetary value in exchange for what they're doing.
I'd like to take a step away from this topic for just a moment, because, Will, you have this book, Atlas Shift, Mastering Your Financial Experience in a Post-Information Age. And in that book, you have a lot of these charts that almost look like blueprints. And I know from what we've discussed previously, you know, what we've discussed, this is stuff that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, working to help maintain and manage people's estates, their financial futures and all of this. This is the day-to-day grind for you. And sure. I'd like to give the viewers just a quick look at what your day-to-day looks at. Talk just a moment about your company and also about how you determine the first steps in helping somebody with their estate. Maybe some sort of a quick analysis they could do.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of power in visualization. You know, we're visual creatures. I think that, those charts are not in there by accident. I think that my day to day would probably surprise a lot of people. I usually get up with the market, here. So we're Pacific time here. So, at 6:30, the market opens.
Right.
And I do have strategies that I run, for my clients that, are traded on a daily basis. Now that doesn't mean that we are day traders, but we keep a close enough eye on the market that when the market is open, our eyes are on the market. And so that said, it's usually dealing with trading in investment type stuff until about 1 p.m. And then I flip the switch towards what we call the advanced planning part of wealth management, which is kind of talking with people about, their trusts and their wills and their life insurance and their property and casualty insurance, their home in insurance and kind of tying up the rest of the financial plan. Because and I talk about this in my book, the things that the majority of people care about are the following five things. They are, people want to make smart decisions with their money. They want to mitigate the impact of taxes. They want to protect their wealth from economic downturn and as well as predatory people.
Right.
They want to take care of the people that they love. And then they want to usually give to some version of a charitable cause or a religious organization. Those five things, it's really important that you do number one, because without number one, you can't do the other four. And so the way in which I set people up to do that is we go through what I call a discovery meeting, which is, it lasts about 90 minutes long. It goes through 60 or so questions regarding your values and your interests and your goals and your assets and your relationships and pretty much anything that is connected towards money in your house. We ask a question about it. Mm. And from the outcome of that interview, we put together a mind map for people, what we call a total client profile, which is you're in the center of it, and kind of coming out on all sides of it are all the things that we talked about in the meeting, which is, who are the people that are important to you and what do you think about money and why is it important to you and what are your goals and what are all the things that you want to accomplish. And it actually ends up, it's really cool. I call it the kind of the 3D snapshot of kind of where you are now, because if we can get that right? Like, I think it was Einstein that said it. If you had an hour to solve a problem to save the human race, Einstein said he would have taken 55 minutes to develop the right question. Because when you have the right question, the answer comes pretty easily. That is, in a sense, what I believe that we do in the discovery meeting is we develop the right question, which is what is truly, kind of what aligns with your constitution as far as your goals, dreams, and what's important to you, and who are we there to really help in the long run. And
I want to pause you for a moment there, because sure. Some of the listeners might not realize how powerful what you just said was. I want everybody who's listening to this podcast right now to understand a very important thing about a lot of financial planners, estate managers, anybody who engages in the long-term investment of any sort of assets, any of those planning aspects. A lot of them have huge predispositions, glaring predispositions, to the fact where some people won't accept a client that's, let's say, under the age of 40, because they only want to deal with long-term, you know, safer conservative investments. And, you know, people around 20 to 30 are looking for something that's a little bit more aggressive. And that kind of messes with their profile, and their portfolios all get out of whack. So it's really interesting, and I think it's really powerful, incredibly powerful, how you focus on making sure that what you're creating is the right question to find the best path for your clients, and not how do they best fit in and what you've predisposed as the way to be safe and secure for your company for the next 40 years.
Yeah, that's kind of going back to what we talked about at the top of the podcast, which is, you know, I believe that I'm uniquely positioned in order to deliver this to people because I've been doing this just long enough to know what I'm doing, but not so long that I've been indoctrinated by the old guard of Wall Street.
Yes.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's like I started on Wall Street in May of 2008. I rode the downturn out with everybody else. You know, I was literally on Wall Street. I started at Smith Barney, and I came out to Los Angeles, and I worked for Merrill Lynch, and I worked at Deutsche Bank for a little while doing options and offshore securities. I know I've worked at the big banks long enough to know what they're doing for their folks and why it's wrong. And I went independent 4 years ago because I believed that I could provide a superior service and what I talk about in the book, which is the financial experience, because you're not going to stick with something that you're not engaged with.
Right.
So if you don't provide people an experience, then they'll go and find someone who will. And that's why I believe, I mean, the experience is really what it's all about today. Because of Uber and Airbnb, they're all providing you experiences. We compare experiences across industries. It's not just within your own industry.
It's so interesting. It is so interesting that we have you on this podcast, because previously, the first episode of the We All Succeed podcast was done with one of my clients, Retta, who's a former investment banker executive at some of those companies that you actually just named on Wall Street, who also has left the Wall Street life. Well, he left the Wall Street life to create his own entrepreneurial business, got a small business loan for $1.3 million and purchased Alehorn, and now sells Viking horns and stuff like that all over the world and is thriving. But he also told us the way that the game was played before is not how the game is played now. And it's so interesting to have you come on here, Will, and tell us, well, first off, all these funds that people were relying on and these institutional protections aren't really so much there. We know of them, they exist, but we can't really rely on them, and we're not going to be able to rely on them because at the very bare minimum, they're going to change and be different than what they were before. It's going to be a different game. But at the best case scenario, even if it stayed exactly as it is now, they would just have no money in them. And it's very interesting seeing, you know, two very, very competent people coming to us from Wall Street, you know, with previous history in making these the financial decisions or maintaining and managing assets, telling us, okay, so I hear what you're saying about these institutions protect people, but also they don't right now. So find other ways, find the right questions, find a new way to, if you want to feel in any way, shape, or form safe and protected moving into the next 10 years, really. You said 2023?
I think some of the projections, I mean, the Social Security projections are kind of all over the place.
We're not going to hold you to it.
I think that 2034 is the latest one that I heard.
Wow. That's 20 which years. Is, less than.
Yeah. That's, yeah. That's,
yeah.
It's
like 15 years from now.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, going back to what we were kind of talking about before about the big bank side of things, it's like what I talk about, one of the questions I ask in my book is, can you think of any industry that relies on the exact same business models that did, you know, 20 years ago? It's like everything has been disrupted.
Right.
You know, I really don't even know how the financial services industry got this far the way that it did. I think a lot of it has to do with regulation and all sorts of stuff. But to me, the amount of people out there that are actually very well intentioned, but that don't see that we are in a faster, more connected, more violent, interconnected global economy than ever before, why we think that the tools of the 80s are going to help us. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And so one of the things that, you know, I think that we talked about before and probably what your previous guest talked about or at least operates with is that, you know, you kind of have to be a tinkerer of sorts. You have to go and be able to go in and dismantle things and then try and put them back together and maybe look a little bit better way, right? It's like, that's what I do with my investing strategies. It's like, I don't think that asset allocation and the way that we know it today, which is, you know, taking some stocks and some bonds and throwing them in a portfolio and saying, okay, you have to take what the market gives you. Like, that's ridiculous. That's such a passive way to go about things. Like, if passive doesn't work in your relationships or your business or, you know, your professional stuff or whatever it is, like, why is it supposed to work for you in investing? It's like, let's be active in our own pursuit of what we want in life.
And just to provide a little visibility for some of the people who are listening about some of the things that we're talking about. During a lot of the financial crisis that was going on, there were literally 8 guys from multiple law firms sitting inside on Capitol Hill trying to rewrite things to be able to make it so that our nation could even survive. I happen to be friends with one of those people, Marlon Powell, who used to be from Locke and Lord. And, you know, just there's so many people who we just don't have the visibility on to say thank you to be able to make our country actually continue. 8 people made our country actually move forward. This was, I believe, during the Obama administration when there was a huge financial disaster and there was just like everybody was shutting down and Republicans were warring against Democrats and everybody was just mad at each other. And during that situation, there was just 8 guys sitting in a room that made it possible for us to continue. And that's not the only time that's happened in the nation's history either. So what we have is an entire system of structures that has kind of been duct taped together. And what's amazing is that a tinkerer, as you said, or I refer to it as a fiddler, somebody who's going to actively take maintenance on something like yourself, William, you've created a blueprint that helps us navigate a lot of those pieces that really, honestly, there's only a few chefs with very different mindsets, but a few chefs who really duct tape this thing back together. And having something that's able to consistently work, maintain and manage assets, whether it's $1 million or more, or in some cases even less, you know, you've put together something that's going to work and be consistent. And consistency in finance is ridiculous. The idea of it is ridiculous, especially when we're talking about stocks and all that kind of stuff. So
absolutely.
I love all of that about, well, first off, about you as a person, about the way that you go about things and your intentions there, but also about Atlas Shift and how you've kind of took some of those best key points and you've distilled them into something that's accessible and digestible, regardless of who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's vitally important to remember that life is not drawn with permanent marker and, you know, smiley faces on in straight lines.
Yes.
Like there is really no there are no straight, you know, perfectly straight lines and permanent markers. Everything is shades of gray, right? Everything is somewhere in the middle of this, you know, this spectrum. And I think that many times, especially with their financial lives, people look at things in such a black and white way. And it's like, there's not enough people out there that are helping folks with being the arbiter of fear and greed, right? Wow. It's like all of a sudden you know, we have this, we have, you know, an economic downturn, and then everybody is just completely, completely on the fearful end of the spectrum. And then, you know, we have a run up in, you know, markets, and, you know, and now everybody, you know, and their mother wants to buy up things now. It's like, there's, I think it kind of speaks to the polarity of our current system, but that's a whole other topic.
I think that is a whole other topic. And I also think that's your next book, The Arbiter of Greed.
There you go.
That's how that works, right? The books just expand like that. So I don't remember off the top of my head. Currently your book is in pre-order, right? I just happen to have a copy of it. Your book is in pre-order right now.
Yeah. So yeah, I gave you, I gave you a, actually a copy of it before it, it went to the designer. Actually, so I'm right in the middle of creating the book galleys. I mean, I've really found it interesting. I mean, this might be an interesting point for some of your listeners, in that the one of the biggest things that you learn when publishing a book is the attention to detail is just enormous. It's like, you know, you want to put things, you want to put the words on the page, and then you want to make sure that the words look right, and that, you know, the paragraphs are spaced out correctly, and that, you know, do you want the page number in the lower right-hand side or the upper right-hand side? And do you want the title of the chapter above, or do you want the title? It's like, there are so many different decisions to make when going through all of this. It really is a lesson in being patient around ironing out the details, because the details, it seems as if the, you know, kind of God is in the details. Like, you get all the details right, then the big picture kind of comes to fruition. So
you brought it up. Hold on. Nope. There's no getting away from it. You brought it up. I wasn't going to talk about publishing, but we dive into the trenches here. So because you brought up the publishing, I've got to ask at least one question about it.
Okay.
How did you determine what the best publisher for you was?
So I found out that if I went too far down the traditional publishing route, that I would probably not be able to communicate the things that I wanted to in the book the way that I wanted to, which is, it seems as if the bigger the publisher, the more cooks you have in the kitchen, and you know, the meal may not turn out as you want it to. And so I chose a small publisher, kind of in between us, really. They're in Orange County. They've been, you know, very helpful on the spot. But they're really just there to help out with, you know, the paperwork and getting the ISBN and Library of Congress and all of that stuff. And then I have kind of final say on everything else. And to me, the creative license was more important than having a big publisher name.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because Jill Lublin, who I will get, I swear I will get her on one of these. She's a dear friend, absolute sweetheart. She's one of the lovely people who started off in publicity. She's a publicist. Her main thing, other than helping people with their publicist needs, she is also one of the people that takes books overseas and sells them to overseas markets. So a lot of, you know, American published people going to England and that kind of thing, or Germany, you know, whatever type of book it is, she's the person who's really going to take it to all the places it needs to go to get the international publishing rights. And you actually cannot do that so easily if you have a publisher who is really stringent, like a Penguin Publishing or somebody like that, who's going to take over complete ownership over the book, because they then own the assets. So if you, like, you can't even take your, if you made a book and you had one of the entrenched publishers, there's plenty of publishers, and that's not to say the same thing about self-publishing, and there's some in-between publishers, which are kind of where I prefer to go to personally. Right. But if you use an entrenched publisher, right, you're not going to be able to even take it and distribute it through Barnes & Nobles or Walden Books or any of those places, because they now have their own. Well, as long as you own the rights to it, we can distribute through these places. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the publisher is only going to send to these markets the kind of places, you know, the kind of books that they specifically want to push above and beyond the other ones.
Right.
So it's very interesting. And I feel like there's always, I probably could talk, we probably will do one of these podcasts strictly and solely on the publishing industry and all of that. But right now, we've got an amazing book in front of us. Do we have the date of when that comes out?
As of right now, the date is January 4th. I think that it'll probably stay there by now. It's moved a couple times on me, but I think it'll stay there now.
Well, I hope it does, because I know there's a lot of people who are going to be looking forward to this book. Atlas Shift is not only just an incredible – the idea of how it gets formulated and focusing on post-information age is huge, but the fact that you are a financial expert, somebody who maintains and manages assets above $1 million, you know, that's your day-to-day, is trading these stocks and taking care of these things up to 1 o'clock and then really moving on to keeping the planning going. That's your day-to-day life. These are the kind of people that I keep encouraging other people to get their advice from. It's not about some person who's standing on a stage who sounds really cool but actually has a very leaky business. It's about somebody who's winning in these categories and absolutely crushing it in their industry. These are the people we should be going and getting the right advice from, because usually their advice is very different than a person who's standing on stage or somebody who you would meet who's supposed to be an expert of these things and really has no idea what they're talking about. So I think Atlas Shift is going to be one of my stocking stuffers. Mastering your financial experience in a post-information age is a topic that every entrepreneur I know needs to be looking at, if at the very least to encourage them to use their P&L reports, their profit and loss reports, because they're just not even, you know, not even looking at these things. So whether it's encouraging them in their business or in their personal life, William Rassman, I really appreciate having you on here.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
One last thing before you escape us and return to the wonderful world of winning. I want to ask, is there anything, any last tidbit that you have for us, or any last request that you have for us, or a charitable cause or something that you personally follow, anything along those lines?
So I am, I've gone back and forth between, what types of charity I think work best. And it seems to me that, that early childhood, like what happens to you before the age of five, really matters a lot. And so if there's, anybody listening, or anybody that, listening that knows people that have those types of nonprofits going on, feel free to look me up and find me. And I'm looking to get more into that space, because there's just so many different things that people are doing out there for nonprofit work and charity work. And in from what I can tell, I think that early childhood stuff is the stuff that really moves the needle for people. And I don't know, it's something that has come to me very recently, actually, in life. I haven't always been kind of interested in that, but as I kind of get older and kind of look at the world through a little bit of a different lens, that seems to matter more.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I just received we might even revisit this and invite you back on here to talk about that, because we actually recently have gotten a lot of attention on that. We've got some very close friends, actually not too far down the street from you, Forever Home for Foster Kids, which helps find homes for the foster kids that are displaced, whether it's due to tragedy or otherwise. And there's a lot of organizations like that are right out of California and are always just looking to help spread the message. And what I love, this is the thing that really hits me about that. You're so focused on the future by taking advantage of what's available here in the present. And people haven't read your book yet, like I have. But what I can say is that it's really interesting to read financial information that's digestible, that can be applied now, have good effects now, but really be focused towards making sure that these institutions that are supposed to exist to protect you in the future, that you just don't even need.
Yeah.
And that's really powerful. Thank you. Thank you again for joining us here on the We All Succeed podcast. William Rassman,
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Blessings to you. Bye for now.